Dr. Simeon Hine has been doing interesting work for years, originally getting his PhD from Washington State University in 1993 in sociology. He's been working with people and opening their minds. In fact, that's the title of one of his books, Opening Minds, A Journey of Extraordinary Encounters, Crop Circles, and Resonance. And if you hear that word a lot, know that he was ahead of the curve on this. He's been instructing people in the art of resonant viewing, as well as the scientific study of crop circles and other subtle energy phenomenon. In fact, it's very interesting to look at the world through the mind of Simeon Hine, and we'll do that with Dr. Hine next. We'll explore these crop circles and his unique view of what he thinks is creating them, as well as what he thinks the byproduct is of their creation. Dr. Simeon Hine, it's a pleasure to chat with you, although I have to tell you right up front, the DVD that I was expecting of your work never arrived. So I've spent a lot of time on your website, but I'm really interested in the work you've been doing. So I hope that I can one day take a look at that personally. Good morning. How are you?
Good afternoon. Morning, Ian. Thanks for having me here today. And, you know, just to straighten that out, I think you're talking about Larry Noonan's DVD, Circle Speak.
Yes.
I think he's produced a wonderful DVD about crop circles, and we'll find a way to get that to you pretty soon.
Yeah, well, because there's so much about this which remains a mystery, although we learned a lot more about crop circles, certainly some of the work that you have done that's on your website, and we'll get back to that in just a minute. And I also reserve the right to return to resonant viewing, because I find your descriptions and your classes about that to be very interesting, the way you differentiate between resonant viewing and remote viewing, and how you teach one and how you see what the dynamics are of resonant viewing. I find that very intriguing.
Absolutely.
And especially, you're teaching classes all over the world. I saw pictures of your Japanese classes.
Right. I've been teaching resonant viewing in Japan since 2003, and we also teach our classes here in Boulder, Colorado. In fact, we're doing our intermediate class this weekend.
All right. So when you go to Japan, do you need an interpreter, or are you fluent in Japanese?
No, I have an interpreter, Ian,
okay. And
these interpreters do a great job of kind of conveying some of these complex topics into Japanese.
I was going to say, because this is sometimes difficult stuff to talk about in English.
Yeah, that's right.
Your command of Japanese would have to be extraordinary,
right.
I imagine. How did you make the transition from a sociology teacher into researcher in this way?
Well, Ian, what happened is, you know, I got a PhD in sociology back in 1992, as you mentioned. I used to teach statistics and social research methods. And a couple of years later, I heard a man named Dr. Courtney Brown talking on the radio, my local radio station here, about remote viewing, and this is an idea I'd never heard before. And he said that everybody had this natural innate ability to perceive non-local information, you know, get information about people and places and objects that were distant from them, that they couldn't get from their five physical senses. And he had written a book about this, and he was teaching classes at the Farsight Institute in Atlanta, and I was so intrigued by this idea because partly I was so skeptical, based on my training as a sociologist, that anybody, you know, apart from a natural psychic could actually do something like that. And I went and took his class, partly just to see if it was true that people actually had this innate ability to do remote viewing. And I found after a few days that not only was I getting results that I really couldn't explain, but that everybody in the class was getting really amazing results. They could actually describe pictures that were in folders that they hadn't seen ahead of time and draw pictures of them, describe them in great detail. And when I did this for the first time, I really said, you know, there's something going on here that I didn't learn about in my 27 years in school, and I need to find out more about this. And that's how I made this whole transition into the world of subtle energy science and a lot of the topics that, you know, that we talk about on Coast all the time.
What was that first breakthrough experience? What did you draw, or what were you able to capture with remote viewing?
We were viewing the target of Cancun, Mexico, and we had that picture that I'm sure many people have seen of all those hotels along the beach.
Right.
And I had drawn a picture of what looked like a beach with these hotels on it, and when we were given the cue to kind of move into the target and get closer, I began to hear people speaking Spanish inside these buildings. And I thought that I was just making this up. You know, I mean, we just have this blank sheet of paper and a protocol to follow in front of us. And I thought, well, I don't know what I'm getting here, but you're just supposed to pay attention to the process and be detached from the outcome. And I completed the session, and when I saw the picture, it was actually very close to the picture that I had drawn in my phase three drawing, at the stage where you draw pictures. And I had actually heard people speaking Spanish in my mind, and I saw the hotels there, and I said, wow, actually, I was there. It was almost like I was there in the remote viewing session. And that really made a big impression on me that actually I could do something that I didn't think I could do, but there I had done it. And a lot of other people in the class were too, and I really said, you know, there's something really important going on here that I need to understand. And since that time, I've been, you know, studying the topic of remote viewing and now teaching it as well.
Well, but let me back up for a second. So
sure.
Why isn't that just vivid imagination?
Well, you know, you're right, Ian. If you just did this once, you might say, well, you had a lucky guess. But if you see yourself doing this repeatedly day after day, the course that I originally took was an 8-day course. If you see yourself getting these repeated results, that is the hallmark of some sort of scientific effect going on. And, you know, that's what we're taught in science classes. If you see this effect repeatedly, then something's really going on that you need to pay attention to. There is always that debate. Is this just purely an answer you're getting by luck? Just the results are just purely by chance. But if that were the case, you'd expect to miss most of the targets, right, and only get some of them once in a while. But if you're getting good target contact every third target or something like that, that's well above what you would expect to get by chance, and that would show you that there's actually a real effect going on there. And especially seeing so many other people get the same results. These targets were done blind.
Right.
There really was no way. But, you know, your mind goes through all the possibilities. Maybe I saw the target somehow, or, you know, there's some contamination going on here. The information is leaking through. In fact, all the people at SRI where these techniques were originally developed, you know, 30 years ago, they had to kind of control for all these possible sources of information leakage that might kind of give you an alternate explanation of how someone could do that. But once you control for all those factors, you just have to conclude there's something else going on that you can't explain. The information is traveling through another pathway
right
into your mind, into your awareness, that is not traditional. It's not explainable by any traditional scientific idea that we know about.
Just, again, indulge me for a second. Have you ever submitted this back into the, you know, into the halls of academia from which you came?
Yes, I have from time to time. I did present some of this information at some sociology conferences, and I did get a receptive welcome from some of the younger students and, you know, recent graduates.
Okay.
Some of the older people are a little suspicious of this, and I got to tell you, Ian, a lot of books are written from academia trying to explain this phenomena away. In other words, rather than looking at it as potentially a real new scientific phenomena, the books that are written about this, the general approach is, why do people believe in weird things?
Yeah.
And, you know, there are a lot of weird things that turn out to be fact 20 years later. People didn't believe in the Wright brothers either for the longest amount of time. You know, I mean, think of all the scientific inventions that at the time were considered hoaxes. So I think it's very valid to take the other point of view rather than why do people believe in weird things. You also could take the point of view, is it possible there are other processes and new phenomena, or at least phenomena that we're not very, we don't understand very well. Could those phenomena be going on and we just don't understand it yet? And that's the position I've been taking ever since I had my experience getting good target contact in remote viewing sessions.
What's the difference between that and an OBE?
You know, it seems to be a scale of contact. The OBE is really a situation where you're either leaving your body or having the perception that you've left your body. I think that remote viewing, or what we call resonant viewing, is kind of more a lightweight version of that. You're actually not going anywhere. It's more that you're using your body and your mind like an antenna to receive information. And it may feel from time to time that you're actually at the target site. And I know some of the military viewers that were in the government military remote viewing program actually think that it's like that. But what I suspect is really going on is that your conscious mind is so good at assembling all the information that comes into your senses every second. It's kind of recreating a virtual reality in your mind, and it feels like you're there. But I don't think you're actually physically there, at least not in the CRV type of protocol that we use, you know, the protocol that was invented at SRI that the military eventually used. It seems more that you actually feel like you're there. And in a very intense session, you get what we call bilocation. You actually feel like the room disappears around you, and you feel like you're at another target location. That happened to me once when we were doing a target about the destruction of the dinosaurs, and I actually ended up in what felt like a swamp. And I could actually see kind of like these creatures around. It was very strange. And then when I later found out this actually was a target about dinosaurs. You know, that was really quite astounding. But occasionally that does happen, like you feel like you're there. But I think, you know, OBEs, like, they do more like at the Monroe Institute, where you're trained to kind of create that out-of-body feeling or maybe actually literally go somewhere. I think that's a little different than the remote viewing protocol, which is a little more a milder version of that.
When you say not physically there, I would think the term more apt might be not psychically there. You're not, you know, I mean, would you describe going into that hallway in the hotel in Cancun and hearing people speaking Spanish? I would think in a way that you are psychically there, but you aren't physically there.
Right. I would agree with that.
Okay. And what's the difference? Does anybody use the term astral projection anymore?
Right. That's also a related phenomenon where you're actually projecting what we'd call your subtle energy body.
Right.
Again, same idea into a different location. The idea that you may be traveling around, maybe when you dream at night, into different places. And again, that's kind of, I believe, a more just a more intense version of the remote viewing experience, rather than just staying here and receiving the information like people do on their radios. You're actually not going to the radio station. You're receiving the information. You actually might be able to project part of your subtle energy body into a different location and perceive those locations from that point of view.
I'll tell you a story. This used to happen to me when I was a little kid, and up until probably about the age of, I think the last time I remember it happening was about 16. I used to experience a kind of out-of-body sensation that would occur when I would go from, so oftentimes from extreme environmental conditions. For example, a cool night walking underneath a hot, bright movie marquee. Back in the old days when they used to have the marquees that actually hung out over the sidewalks.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, where you would walk and there would be a million flashing lights and it would be hot underneath the big marquee that would float out in front of the box office. And a couple of times that sort of thing would happen. I'd come out of a cool store and step outside into a bright, you know, hot parking lot. And I would have the feeling that, and I would have the visual ability, it would seem, to look down on top of myself. And I went through this probably a couple dozen times, and I would be able to sort of have a distant relationship with my physical presence, where even a friend of mine, I remember once, punching me in the arm because he'd been talking to me and I hadn't been paying any attention to him because I was floating above, what felt like floating above myself, looking down at me, and I remember him hitting me in the arm, and only the sensation of him hitting me in the arm brought me back to my physical presence in my body. What does that sound like to you?
Well, you know, Ian, I've had that happen a couple times also in kind of different circumstances, but there was some sort of shock or something, and all of a sudden I felt like I was floating out of my body by a few feet.
Right.
And I honestly don't know exactly what that is. I've always wondered, is that just a perception of being out of my body, or is there some part of my awareness which really was out of my body? I don't totally know the answer, but it's really an interesting phenomena, and it's certainly, you know, related to what we're talking about here.
I once mentioned it to my mother when I was about 14 or 15 years old, and she looked at me with these saucer-like eyes, and she asked me to describe it again, and I did. And my mother, who was not prone to these kind of conversations, said to me, "That is so weird, because I used to have that same thing happen to me when I was a girl." When she was a little girl, she said, and her experiences went away during puberty. Mm-hmm. And she said, and I never had them again. And I haven't either. I mean, I think the last time I had it was 16. Well, and after that, I've never had them again. And I've wanted to have them again because I think they were fascinating.
They're kind of fun, yeah. Well, you know, we have those reports from people in hospitals sometimes, you know, who have near-death experiences or giving birth or something, and they may die for a few minutes or just be under such stress that they kind of pass out, and they're later able to describe, like, the inside of the walls,
right,
of the elevator or the outside,
sure,
of the building or something. There's no way they could have seen, you know, physically.
Sure.
And you have to wonder maybe that they were literally floating outside of their body in some way. You know?
Well, what's the difference between remote viewing and resonant viewing? Describe how you see that.
The difference is mainly in the way we look at it. You know, the idea of remote viewing is that you're here in the room somewhere, wherever you are, and you're viewing a distant object. But we know from quantum mechanics that, in a sense, there really is no distance, that everything is really different, you know, at a different frequency. And so the reason you can do remote viewing is because there isn't really anything that's remote. In other words, everything that is that exists in our universe gives off a frequency of energy. And by tuning into that frequency, you can pick up the energy, the information about that thing or person or place. And so we really think that what remote viewing is an ability for you to match the frequency of another object or person. And just like when you're tuning into a radio, you know, you tune into the station and boom, you know, the station comes through your radio. When you can tune into the resonance of different things, the information seems to spontaneously flow to you across this quantum field and into your awareness. And so it's more a form of resonance matching rather than remote viewing. When you think of it as remote viewing, then you think, well, how am I getting over there? You know, how is it possible for the information to get from there to here? But if you look at it more as a frequency, that everything is just kind of emitting its own kind of subtle energy radio signals, at least as an analogy, then it's not quite as much of a puzzle of how it's possible to do this in the first place. So it's more just the way we look at it rather than a different sort of protocol or a different method. It's just that we think of it more as a type of frequency matching like a intergalactic radio rather than as really you going somewhere else, your astral body projecting into a different location.
You're your own SETI project.
In a sense, yeah.
Okay. And so does everything then have a frequency? You use things with frequency, and I'm trying to understand that. Do you have, as opposed to people with energy, you're talking about even like waves from things?
Yes, everything that exists, period, has some sort of frequency at the location in the matrix of space and time. And this frequency, it seems, based on, you know, what we've seen, the human has the ability to tune into this through a process that I don't thoroughly understand, and I don't think anybody does. But somehow our subconscious can, through the nature of intent, tune into those different frequencies, and spontaneously the information appears in your awareness. You write it down on your paper, and it's like magic. You describe a non-local event or person or place.
When you say resonance in that sense, then is and frequency, I would think that frequencies of things, if not people, would have there be an element of decay to the energy that's expressed by a thing or a person, that over time that energy wave would diminish. So
yeah, that's a really good point, and it doesn't seem to happen that way, Ian.
Really?
Yeah, all the results seem to suggest that this non-local energy doesn't decay with distance, which has led a lot of researchers to suspect that it's not an electromagnetic signal, right?
Right.
I mean, the Coast show right now, if it's being emitted by some radio station somewhere, it's going to decay as it goes out from the Earth farther and farther into the solar system. But these remote viewing signals, these resonant signals, do not seem to decay with distance, and their experiments have been done with that. With the viewer Ingo Swann when he viewed one of the planets as the Voyager mission, I think it was Uranus, he viewed a ring there before Voyager even got there. And they've done some experiments with putting viewers in submarines in the Pacific.
Sure, I've heard about those.
Yeah, and they didn't find that there was any decay in accuracy. Now, normally seawater is kind of an impediment to an electromagnetic signal, right? And you have to have these really long wave antennas for submarines to communicate with land-based stations. But
okay. It
doesn't seem that the viewers become any less accurate when you put them underwater.
Well, and partly I'm thinking about when you're remote viewing over time, you know, here you have, you know, you talked about going back into an ancient swamp. You would think that the energy from that swamp would have long since decayed and no longer exist. So how do you tune into that frequency of a place that existed millions of years ago?
Right. Well, what it suggests and is that time doesn't exist the way we think it does at some other level. That possibly, and I know this is a little difficult to understand logically, everything is happening at once in a parallel reality, and you're simply tuning into that reality. It's actually right next to you. You can't physically see it, but it's in a different space. And your subconscious can tune into it. But that does raise a lot of questions, but it does seem that all the events of the past and the future are already here right now, and that's how viewers are able to describe some of these events and sometimes predict even future events.
That means in a parallel reality, I can redo the first hour of the show?
Yeah, it almost suggests that you can things are happening in lots of different ways all at once.
All right, it's a big concept. We'll leave that there.
Okay.
That brings us up to crop circles then, and remote viewing in the dark. And creating crop circles and knowing which ones are faked and which ones are real and what comes real out of even the faked ones. Next with our very good friend here and loving this conversation, Dr. Simeon Hine on Coast to Coast AM. So we're talking with Dr. Simeon Hein, who's the author of a book called Opening Minds, A Journey of Extraordinary Encounters, Crop Circles, and Resonance. We've been talking about resonant viewing and other subtle energy phenomena. But how do you tie that together with crop circles? How are those two things connected? Well, we'll talk about that coming up next, and also probably touch on his new book that's coming out, Planetary Intelligence, 101 Easy Steps to Energy, Well-Being, and Natural Insight, next on Coast to Coast AM. Well, we're opening our minds with Dr. Simeon Hein, and we're grateful for all this very interesting information about crop circles, which I'll get to in just a moment. Let me just also ask you, when's that book, Planetary Intelligence, coming up?
Well, Planetary Intelligence is actually available right now as an ebook download, but the printed version should be available around January 2006.
And they can link up to the ebook download at your website?
Right. They can go to the Opening Minds website and click over to Planetary Intelligence and, download the ebook. They can just sign up on our mailing list, and I'll let them know when the printed version is available.
Who is Mount Baldy?
Well, Mount Baldy Press is actually my own self-publishing company that I started,
right.
And it used to be actually the Remote Viewing Institute, which we now changed to a federally recognized nonprofit, a 501c3. It's now called the Institute for Resonance, and people that take our resonant viewing classes, you know, can actually take a tax deduction because we're a nonprofit.
But, I mean, it's not named Mount Baldy because of a receding hairline.
No, you know, actually, Ian, that is named after a mountain in near Santa Fe, New Mexico.
Okay.
We did a lot of remote viewing on this particular mountain back at the Farsight Institute because there was a lot of indication that there may be some extraterrestrial activity there, and I just thought it was kind of a neat name, and it became the name of the website and the Institute for a while.
I was just trying to understand.
That's right.
And I'm very interested in this idea, too, about some of the pictures I saw on your website of these crop circles.
Right.
And let's talk about this work, because what percentage of crop circles that have appeared, say, even on the Coast to Coast AM website or,
yes,
you know, around the world, what percentage of them are valid? What do you think how many of those are man-made hoaxes?
It's a big question, Ian, and let's rephrase that a little bit.
Please do.
Yeah. There was a time when I actually thought that people could not even make a crop circle. I mean, there was a lot of good evidence back in the 90s that it just was way too complex at night to do even something like that, the ones we see on the Coast to Coast website and on the Opening Minds website. And there was a time I didn't think it was possible to do that. I went over with a man named Ron Russell, taking one of his crop circle tours, which he gives every year. I went over in 1997 after learning about crop circles, doing remote viewing sessions on them. I was very curious about them. And going over there and seeing these huge patterns in English wheat fields, I just thought this was simply not something that people could do. I mean, the architectural firm said it would take 4 or 5 days in the daytime to make one of these, and no one had ever been seen making these. And Colin Andrews actually has a database of about 40 to 50 sightings of crop circles actually being formed in about 10 or 15 seconds of people up early hours of the morning. Now, those are all simple circles or groups of circles. But around the year 2000, I actually, and Ron Russell also, we were approached by so-called circle makers. And we thought these people were actually just faking this. We didn't think they could do anything. But they invited us out to actually watch them make a circle in the daytime, a paid internet advertisement where the farmer had been paid ahead of time.
Now, this is daytime.
Already
the conditions are a little bit different, but you had bit hard on the idea that these were all authentic, so
right, that's right.
You took the challenge.
I did take the challenge, Ian. I actually didn't want to believe that people could do this. I actually liked the idea of the original kind of Colin Andrews, Terrence Meaden idea that this was something being produced by ionic plasmas, perhaps some sort of unknown Earth intelligence or extraterrestrials, which I actually believe those three forces are involved in some of the crop circles. I thought those explained, you know, those three phenomena explained all of the crop circles. But when I saw these individuals, this was actually Matthew Williams, make one in the daytime, you know, it was rather small. He did a good job with it, but it was in the daytime, and I wasn't really convinced that could really be applied to the pitch black that you get in the dark in England at night. But then I was invited by another group, and I wrote about this in Opening Minds. I have some pictures of that particular circle. I was given a shape ahead of time and told that I could watch a group make this at night. And I actually took them up on this challenge. I was just so curious. I didn't think they could do it, but they did. They did it very well, and I was really impressed with their technique. I found that at night they really had developed techniques for really working together as a group. And I later found out that these individuals and about 30 to 40 other individuals, at least in England, just talking about England, that they actually had been making crop circles for about 10 years. I began to know more and more of these people, and they began to trust me and share more of their information with me, and I began to see some of the books of their patterns, and I even got to see circles that hadn't been made yet, and lo and behold, they'd appear a couple weeks later, you know?
Right.
And I began to change my view of what was going on there, and I wasn't comfortable with it at first, and I know a lot of people are not.
How many people were making these crop circles in this community that you talked about?
About 40, 30 to 40.
Wow. How many would show up in it? They would like send out like a mass email or something and say, hey, we're all gathering in such and such a place and we're going to make, you know, pattern 5B. I mean, is that how it would work? I mean, they knew what pattern they were going to make when they got there.
Oh, absolutely. These patterns are planned out very carefully ahead of time, week for week sometimes. And the fields are carefully selected according to other circles that have appeared in those fields in the past, the geography of the area. They'll consider how the shape will, you know, aesthetically kind of affect the whole field. And they take a lot of things into consideration. I was really impressed with their care and their sincerity. I actually thought these people were hoaxers, you know, guys that going out after a night in the pub. That's what we had been told, and that's what I had been told by a lot of the researchers at a lot of these, you know, crop circle conferences. I thought that was true. What I actually found were people that believed that crop circles are what they call natural magic. They had been experiencing a lot of really weird stuff out there at night. And I began to realize these aren't hoaxers. These are kind of like natural magicians who know that crop circles really do attract a lot of really strange stuff, Ian, and stuff that we can't totally explain. And these crop circle artists are actually believers like us in crop circles, except that they're, at least in England, they're making a lot of them.
All right.
So to answer your question, I think in England, probably a lot of them are being made by people, if not most of them. As
give
far
me a percent,
as the rest of the
80%,
world, I don't know.
80%, 90%?
Yeah, something like that, maybe even more.
All right. So,
but it hasn't always been that way. I'm just talking in the recent, the last 10 years or so. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. But so let's say 80 or 90% of those, let's just limit it to England. Who knows about India? Who knows about Asia? Who knows? But let's just say 80 to 90% are faked. Or they are created, not faked, but they're created. And they were avoiding detection. It was highly organized, but now we understand what it was. But you still think that 10% then are created by something else. What else is creating that other 10 to 20%?
There's a couple other sources. You know, back in the 60s in Australia, there were something called saucer nests. People would see UFOs and have UFO sightings. And the next morning they'd find that the reeds or other plant material was swirled down in a circle, and it became known as saucer nests. And actually some of the original so-called hoaxers, Doug and Dave, you might have heard of them, the guys from the pub, they actually were attempting to recreate what they had seen in Australia, which were apparently genuine circles, so to speak, created by UFOs or UFO propulsion systems. I've actually spoken to people that have either seen this or know people that have seen this themselves, actually witnessed this sort of event. A lot of lights flashing at night, and the next morning there's some sort of circle there. I think that explains a certain percentage of the circles in different parts of the world. This is also seen in New Zealand. So UFOs, even in this country, there's a wonderful book called The Secret History of Crop Circles by Terry Wilson. And he goes into the prehistory of crop circles. I mean, we're talking before the modern era, before the 1970s. You know, crop circles have been appearing for a long time. So they're not all explained by the recent rise of people making them. But the people who made them were actually attempting to imitate what they were seeing out there in the fields, which we don't know who or what was making that. So the human interaction with this actually grew out of the other phenomena. Yeah.
You mentioned some sort of earth phenomena, too, perhaps, responsible for this, or
some people have suspected that some sort of earth energy could actually affect the plants in some way. I don't have a lot of evidence that that's what's going on, but certainly as a theory at the time, we considered, you know, maybe this is coming from underground. Maybe it's not coming from above. And, of course, there's the original idea that came from a man named Terence Meaden that this was coming from so-called ionic plasmas, like kind of like a form of electrical discharge from the upper atmosphere, coming down rapidly to the Earth, creating heat and swirling or creating an electrical charge and swirling the wheat down. And while that might have explained some of the simple patterns, you'd really be hard-pressed to kind of think that those really complex ones we're seeing nowadays are explained by that phenomenon. I can't really quite go there with that explanation. But maybe it did explain some of the simple ones in the, you know, maybe 10 or 20 years ago when people actually would witness some of these simple ones forming rather rapidly.
Tell me what you mean by natural magic.
The circle makers I've talked to believe that when you make a crop formation, that it attracts some sort of paranormal energy to the area. And that isn't totally far-fetched. People in subtle energy sciences like Dr. William Tiller call it a conditioned space. The circle makers believe that there's something magical about the space of a crop circle. And, of course, the evidence for that is when they're out there at night, they see balls of light, UFOs, and have strange anomalous experiences. Sometimes they encounter shadow people or their watches don't seem to work correctly, things like that. And then the next day, the rest of us come in as researchers and people that are interested in crop circles, croppies, as we're sometimes called.
Right.
And we have really strange experiences, like we did this summer near Silbury Hill and Avery area. And the pictures, you know, of those circles are on my site. We had 3 days of camera and battery failure repeatedly. And I've seen this. I saw this for the first time in 1999 in a formation called the Devil's Den. My cameras and other equipment, we were using this static electricity meter to measure some of the static energy around the circle, thinking maybe the circles affect the static charge in the area. All that equipment stopped working, and someone came in with a GPS device, and his GPS device, which a few minutes ago had 14 hours of battery life, all of a sudden it wasn't working. You know, these stories have been around for a long time, and I first experienced it in 1999. We experienced it just last August for 3 consecutive days where, you know, camcorders are showing a very strange amount of minutes left on the batteries. We had 3 lithium-ion batteries that would refuse to charge once they had been in a crop circle for about a couple weeks until they got back to the States. They worked again. They would not take a charge even, you know, when we went back to the hotel. So this is why the circle makers call it natural magic, because they think you go out, you make a circle, do your best on it. They actually say prayers and incantations before they make their circle. They're not doing this as a joke. It's very serious for them. They're creating some sort of magical positive effect for the planet. And when we go into the circles, we really experience something strange going on with our equipment, and occasionally people see balls of light, UFOs occasionally. So it's kind of, in a sense, magical. And I actually think of it more as a natural technology. It's almost like a spiritual machine or some sort of organic circuit that really creates effects that we can see occasionally, but we can't totally explain it.
These people who are making crop circles pray to whom or to what? I mean, what do they pray about?
They say incantations for planetary healing, evolution, for people to experience positive effects and magic when they come into the circle the next day. Basically, that the circle itself will have a positive effect on the area and on the people that experience the circle. Basically, that this is going to be create positive energy rather than just be a negative experience or a hoax. They really believe that these circles do something good for all of us, and that's what keeps motivating a lot of them to keep doing it. Not all of them, but a lot of them.
Are they Wiccans?
Some of them, absolutely, yeah. Some of them are definitely in that kind of school of thought.
Earth-based
pagans,
religion.
Yes. Some of them are just artists. A lot of them are artist pagans, if you can imagine that. They believe that there are magical energies in the earth that are unleashed by the process of making a circle. And I know this is a very different story than we've heard about them, but having met these people and kind of meeting up with them every year when I go over there and having contact during other parts of the year, I've come to realize that they're actually a very serious group of artists that really believe that crop circles are important for our evolution in some way. And I tend to agree with them in the sense that a lot of us, our lives have really been changed in some way by being involved with crop circles.
Okay. I'm interested in this idea that they go out to create a crop circle and in doing so change the energy of their space there, and that in doing so then they attract a type of magical phenomena like balls of light or UFOs. Anybody talk about a kind of close encounter? Have any of these UFOs signaled them, given them kind of the, you know, if you flash your brights at somebody coming at you because they've got their brights on, and so they flash back to you, say, hey, I got the message, that kind of thing?
Yes. It can be very similar to that. There's a group of three circle makers who actually call themselves the circle makers. They're from London. And one of them relayed the story once that they were out in the field making a circle, and something came over the circle, very bright, and a light came down on them from this object, but it made absolutely no noise. Now, there's a lot of military activity in that area because you're right near Salisbury Plain, which is a big military operating area for the British military. They don't have all that much space in England, so those things are kind of close together. And you hear the helicopters coming over and the planes, but this object apparently made absolutely no sound, and they were so frightened by it, they hit the deck. And these are three grown guys that are used to being out at night in all sorts of circumstances.
I would think they would be overjoyed. That would be the whole purpose of
doing
that.
Well, you would think so, yeah. But when it happens to you and you really don't know what this is, there was another case very similar to that I heard from a group of circle makers that went out into a circle intending to make a certain pattern near an area called the Tawsmead Copse, which copse is the British word for a forest. It's actually a rather creepy, spooky forest. And these three balls of light kind of began coming towards them from different corners of the field. And they got so petrified, they actually ran out of the field onto the road with their stomping boards and everything, something you normally wouldn't do because you're really not supposed to be out there doing that, you know.
Right.
But here, three big guys with stomper boards ran in panic out of the field after seeing these balls of light. I actually haven't seen the balls of light, you know, in the formations myself. I've seen a lot of good videos, which I think are authentic, that were taken by tourists and other people who happened to be there when they came across. And these balls of light are really strange. They can move up to 200 miles an hour. They seem to be intelligently controlled, and I don't know exactly what they are, but they're attracted to crop circles.
I would hope that there would be video of that.
There is. Yeah. There are about 10 good videos of these balls of light by Alton Barnes and other areas, Barbary Castle, and other good videos that have happened about every year where people are just out there, and all of a sudden they see something coming over the horizon. They seem to actually inspect the crop circle. I don't know any other way to describe it. They seem to go over the crop circle, slow down, speed up. They'll either take off, and they seem to have the ability to disappear right in midair. I mean, if you're looking at the video, you'll be watching them, and all of a sudden, it's just, poof, it's gone. Or in other cases, they seem to get smaller as they come towards the camera rather than bigger. And they're not birds or anything that I know about. You know, I can't explain it easily. I don't think anybody can. They're either small UFOs or probes. I mean, and it suggests the possibility that perhaps extraterrestrials are interested in these circles, the ones that they're not even making. They're inspecting them for some reason. And that would suggest that they're doing something energetically that they're interested in. I mean, it's a possibility.
Have they come up with, and I was looking at some of the ones on your website, and you can link up to Dr. Simeon Hine at coasttocoastam.com, but I was looking at the Devil's Den that you mentioned and the Churchill Formation. And
right.
I'm looking at those. Those are very intricate patterns. Are the people who are designing them and then going out in the fields and stomping them into the grass to try to change the energy of that area and to attract phenomenon, have they developed their own vocabulary in these? Is there a consistency to the ones that they're stomping, or are they just, you know, like spirograph, you know, pop art? Are they just coming up with them? Or have they formed their own kind of, you know, hieroglyphic language?
That's a really good question. And that is still a big mystery to me, exactly where these patterns come from. And I think to some of the circle makers as well, what they've told me is they're actually not sure where these patterns come from. They kind of pop into their minds sometimes, and then they feel compelled to go out and make them. Or in other cases, they just start designing something, and it just kind of manifests itself.
Well,
and they think, well, can we do this in a field? Is this doable? I've seen some patterns that they say, tell me they can't do yet. They don't quite have the ability to do, but they can draw them on paper. And they do have their own vocabulary and own their own system for actually – I mean, imagine you're in the dark with a group of people and you're making a very complex shape.
I get that. I just mean, I wonder whether these probes of which you speak come down to try to read them and try to figure out what we're – saying. Hang on to that answer, and we'll come back to this. We're talking with Dr. Simeon Hine, and we'll continue this conversation with the American crop circles he's been involved with and the phenomena they created with those next on Coast to Coast AM. Back in 1999, reluctantly perhaps, Dr. Simeon Hine started looking into reports that these crop circles had been man-made. Not using the word hoaxed, not using the word faked, but just thinking about them in terms of being made by men and women who saw that they had almost a kind of a sacred impact. They even prayed before they went out and helped to create these crop circles, which they saw as being as much of a beacon to the paranormal as it was perhaps a kind of commentary. And yet, back in 1999, when the first electronic relationship to these crop circles was noticed, where the GPS batteries that Dr. Hine spoke of were drained, where other electronic equipment was affected for weeks, it still was a while before you attempted some of these crop circles in the United States, but you saw the same relationship with the electronic equipment that you were using then and the crop circles that you were creating. Is that right?
Well, to some extent, yes, Ian. And when I make my circles, we do it through the Institute for Resonance, and I work with a team. You know, I don't just do this myself, but I work with Ron Russell and sometimes Peter Sorensen. And we've done these in England, too, by the way, with other circle makers. And we get permission from the farmers ahead of time, just to make that clear. We will either pay the farmer to use their fields, or we give them some sort of compensation. And sometimes they just let us use their fields without any compensation, because they're curious, too. Some of these people are really curious about what these crops are. Some of them always suspected people might have been involved, and they want to see if we can even do something halfway decent, you know.
How much do you have to pay them? Because, I mean, you are destroying part of their crop, but how much of their crop is actually affected by that? We're talking about, you know, a few pounds, a few dollars, or...
It's actually, according to the farmers I've talked to, Ian, it's rather small.
Okay.
All they do is set the thresher a little bit lower when they harvest time, and they're able to get almost all of the wheat. When you make a crop circle, you're actually mechanically, the type that we make mechanically with boards, you're pushing the wheat down. You're not actually killing it. You're not really destroying it. You're pushing it down to the ground. It actually starts growing back up just a few days later if it's still green. And wheat at the end of the season dies anyway. So if it's later in the season, it'll just mostly stay down. But you're actually not destroying the crop. You're actually just pushing it down into a pattern. It reflects the light differently. That's why they look so beautiful from the air. And really what can cause damage is if we get thousands of people walking in these circles. You know, you can imagine you're walking on the seed heads, and that does some damage. And a lot of the farmers will put up collection boxes and make a lot more from the crop tourism than they would from just selling the wheat. But I don't think the destruction is really all that much, at least from making the circle, at least not according to the farmers that we've talked about. We have done it in England and in the U.S., and
like the Kansas Crop Circle experiment of June of 2002, I thought this was fascinating that you had a Trek 520 static electricity meter. The circle you made, you did in 5 or 10 minutes.
Right. It was really small. We had permission to – it was a very small corner of a field, and we made about a 10-foot circle in about, maybe 10 or 15 minutes.
All right. So you make this circle using your standard sort of stock stomping board, but you find that the circle changed the static meter – by over 2,500 volts.
That's right.
That's not insignificant.
No, that's really something. It's really something. And you could imagine if that had been bigger and it had been spread over the size of a football field, like some of these circles are, that could really cause accumulatively a rather big effect in ways that we don't totally understand. But as you point out, that was a small circle, but it still created a huge effect on the electrostatic meter, and especially on Ron's camera. He had a professional F3 Nikon camera that, you know, it doesn't leak light, it doesn't make mistakes. And yet here, on those slides that we took of the crop formation, none of the other slides on that roll of film were affected. It's a film camera. There were slides before the slides of that crop circle and slides after. They were all fine. But on a number of the 18 shots he took of that Kansas formation, a lot of them came out completely black, like there had been no picture taken. And the other ones, like you can see from the pictures on the website, some really strange banding patterns of light are moving across the slides. We don't know what that is. It's blurring in strange ways. That camera has never done that, and it never did it again. But there in that crop circle, we know it's man-made because we made it. It's apparently affecting the film in quite an interesting way, in ways that I don't think anyone really totally understands. But there something is really going on. I mean, what are we photographing there? What is that? Those strange light patterns, they look almost like they're moving across the space there. I don't know what it is, but it's really intriguing.
And you, a student of subtle energy phenomena, if anybody would have an answer, I would expect you would. I mean, what do you think? How do you look at that? Is mean ripples in the dimensions, energy from some other thing, some other past event, or from somebody else that's resonating with what's being done in that circle?
Well, to get at the explanation of why crop circles affect electronics and equipment the way they do, I think you have to look at the entire field, that you have a lot of standing stalks that are planted uniformly by a seed driller. And what you've created by planting those seeds in a very even fashion is a lattice work, very much like you have in a crystal.
Right.
But most of the stalks are standing up. And this is something that Colin Andrews pointed out to me a while back, that a lot of the stalks, when they're standing up, are actually acting like insulators. But when they're pressed down in the crop formation, they're now all touching, and they're actually lying in a lateral, horizontal position. And they're conducting energy or a little bit of electricity. And so what you've got in the crop formation is, while the rest of the field is very uniform, all of a sudden in the crop formation you have a lot of symmetry from the pattern, the overall pattern, and a lot of coherency in the lay pattern of the weed. And that creates what I call a coherent distortion. In other words, you have this very even field, and all of a sudden you have a star-like pattern or a circle or something. It's almost like a defect, but it's a coherent defect. And so the energy in that area is moving differently than in the rest of the field. And I believe that actually is turning that part of the field into something like a photonic crystal. And actually, it's reflecting the sunlight in a very different fashion than the rest of the field. That's one possible reason why it may do what it does. And in turn, when the light is refracted differently, there's a lot of work right now being done in material science about photonic crystals. We think we may actually be creating those photonic crystals right there in the field, which in turn affect electrons and other quantum effects and create some sort of non-locality. In fact, the same effect we see in remote viewing. This kind of non-local effect where we're creating some sort of communication with something else that we can't see.
Well, that brings me back to remote viewing, and I was just trying to go with then how do you tie in resonant viewing with these crop circles? Couldn't one inform the other?
Absolutely. And people in crop circles have a lot of interesting remote viewing type experiences where sometimes they perceive circles that haven't even shown up yet that summer. Isn't that kind of interesting? They can draw them, and yet a couple weeks later they show up, and these aren't people that know the circle makers or anything like this.
They're not the ones that are doing the circle making.
No. They're just people along on the tour or something like that, and they just get this idea in their head. They're in the circle. Lo and behold, a couple weeks later, it shows up. There's almost like a grid being created, a communication system within the circle and between other circles, or some sort of cross-dimensional sort of process. And the way it connects to resonant viewing is that it really shows us that shapes have some sort of subtle energy. And when we do our resonant viewing, the procedure we use, we draw these so-called ideograms, these shapes on the page, just to start the session going, just to kind of create a connection to the subconscious. It seems that these shapes have a sort of energy. They're holographic. And in the same way, the crop circle shapes are holographic. They create some sort of connection to other types of processes and energy that we can just kind of imagine. And in that sense, crop formations and resonant viewing are kind of two sides of the same coin. They're interdimensional processes that happen when people relax a little bit and go into their intuitions and activate their subtle senses and connect with other types of energy information that in our normal waking state we kind of tune out, we push it away. And I believe these sort of processes, this is really what I call planetary intelligence. It's kind of cultivating and activating our own inner intuition and natural intelligence that I believe everybody is born with, but often because of our educational systems and other social conditioning, we don't pay attention to very much by the time we're adults. And so we kind of tune out that natural intuitive information, which I think in some cases can be very powerful and very useful, like it is in crop formations and resonant viewing. You know, when you're doing a resonant viewing session, it's not so much like you're trying to see the object or the person or the place. It's almost like you're getting out of your own way, and then it just happens spontaneously. So these are both very spontaneous natural processes, which I think are very encouraging because they show us that if we access our own natural abilities and the natural energies of the earth, we have a lot of energy and resources available to us that can sustain us and get us through the next couple centuries past the time when we don't have fossil fuels and things like that anymore. So it's almost like, for me, like the edge of a new paradigm. And for a lot of other people researching this, there's like a new paradigm here, new types of energy, new types of information. And it actually, to get to that information, we have to go inside ourselves deeper. We can't access it mechanistically from the outside. We have to go get to it from the inside, from our own awareness and our own intelligence, which is really naturally there. We just have to cultivate it some more. And that's what I call planetary intelligence.
If you're seeking, if you see this rise in static electricity in a given area, 2,500 volts compared to, you know, readings in the rest of the wheat field, then you are getting sort of a quantifiable response. It isn't just a matter of going inside of oneself. You are seeing a kind of causal relationship between crop circles and this, as you call it, natural energy. Why can't we imagine being able to harness that in a purely mechanistic external way?
No, you're right, Ian. We will harness it one day. I'm absolutely confident of that. And we can quantify it. We can measure it. We can look at it scientifically if we want. What I'm suggesting is that the way to get there isn't from a mechanistic point of view. In other words, when you go out to make a circle, you have to intuitively feel, well, which part of the field should the circle go in? And how big should it be? And what sort of pattern should we make? A lot of the time, that comes from people's subconscious. They don't even know exactly how the pattern's going to look until they're done making it. They're like artists. And so what I'm suggesting is that that sort of power is connected to our own intuition rather than some sort of formula that we can know ahead of time.
Right.
It's more that it's something naturally available to us. And when we kind of get out of our way and let that process happen, that's when we get a lot of energy coming out of that circle, some static changes, you know, in the case of the Kansas circle, 2,500 volts.
Right.
Now, that's a lot of energy. And I kind of imagine the day when we're paying farmers to grow wheat as an energy source, not just as a food supply, but maybe if we understand what it is about these patterns that are generating these types of energies, and we don't even know exactly the full potential of this. I mean, our static meter is just measuring one type of charge, but maybe there are other effects going on, quantum effects. This actually could be a case where we're actually seeing macroscopic quantum effects rather than just something that's at the scale of the electron, where the electrons kind of de-localize, and they're actually acting as groups in something that's a kind of a new idea recently in physics, but we may be seeing this in crop circles. There's just a lot of possibilities here. People sometimes go into these circles and feel healing effects. So I think we're really at the edge of something where we're just beginning to understand what it is. And it does have a lot of promise as being something that's very valuable and useful to us in the future, a way to tap into the Earth's energy in a non-destructive sort of symbiotic fashion rather than, you know, the mechanistic technology where we have nowadays, which actually leaves a pretty big footprint on the Earth and I think we can see has some drawbacks.
My background is in theology. So as you talk about wheat, I keep kind of relating that to, you know, the Eucharistic purposes that we have in Christianity for bread and for an understanding that wheat and grapes are, you know, God-given, but that humankind turns around and takes that and creates something out of the wheat. We make bread. Out of the grapes, we make wine. And then I keep thinking about all of the references to bread and wheat that exist in the Bible and how interesting that might be that it ends up being that wheat, just something simple as wheat that had been there all along, that had been part of our, you know, consciousness when we thought about connecting to something divine, might end up being our salvation when it comes to our energy needs.
I mean, right. It's a really intriguing idea.
So then let's go to the one in Washington. You did this one just last summer. St. John, Washington. Tell us about that.
Well, we knew a farmer that was open to the idea of us making a circle on his land. And we believe this is one of the first circles where the farmer actually made it with us. And you can see the pictures right there on the Opening Minds website. You can see the farmer joined in with us. He was so curious about these crop circles. We didn't quite get the chance to do that in a kind of a leisurely way like we like to really do it very carefully because the farmer wanted to participate and we kind of wanted to cooperate with him. So he helped and we didn't quite get the chance to say the incantations we usually like to say. Now, the incantations are important because you're kind of expressing an intent. And, you know, words have energy and power.
Right.
And we believe that just like we found out, you know, from research in The Secret Life of Plants and so forth, and Cleve Baxter and all that research, you know, maybe the plants are responding to the circle in some way, or especially the intention of the people that go in to make the circle. They're maybe interacting in a way they wouldn't when they're just standing up in a very uniform way. That's another possibility we have to consider. We didn't get a chance to do that in the St. John Formation, but we did get a chance to make a circle, and I got some friends in the area that hadn't, you know, ever made a circle before, and it was kind of a fun experience out there, and the farmer was really interested to see what would happen. Unfortunately, he cut it down a couple days later. And really, I'm talking cut it down. I mean, there was nothing left, even in our formation. He had got the whole thing down. It was harvest time in August, and we didn't get a chance to do a lot of the measurements we like to do over time. You know, in that Devil's Den formation in 99, that circle affected batteries for 3 or 4 days after it's made. So we like to see if we can get this effect and how it kind of fades away over time. It does seem to fade away, and we don't know exactly why. Maybe it is that the wheat dries up a little bit, maybe that people are going into it and changing it. The battery draining effect seems to disappear over time, based on my experience. Though I could be wrong about that. It just, on my experience, it seems to happen that way. We didn't get quite a chance to do that in the St. John Formation, but it was, you know, a really interesting experiment to do that and have the farmer, you know, join in.
Right.
And he didn't even ask us for any payment or anything. He was just so curious about crop circles that he just donated the land to us.
And that's cool. Do you notice a pattern in the difference of the energy or the paranormal effect of these humanly created crop circles? Do you notice a difference between those that were created at night and those that were created in the day? And have you ever had a chance to measure any of these crop circles which were not formed by crappies, what ones that might have been formed by something in that other 10 to 20% of crop circles with no human explanation for their appearance?
Well, those are some good questions, and to answer the first one, it seems to me that the effects we're getting mostly happen in the daytime. That's why I suspect that the crop formation is interacting with sunlight. It's almost harvesting light,
okay,
like a photonic crystal. I think that effect comes from the sunlight hitting those stalks at the different angle they're at, and all the effects just from the symmetrical shape of the circle, and all the little stalks are kind of like grains in the crystal, in a sense. So I suspect that those interactions come from the daytime. Now, I have gone out at night and measured some of these circles while we were making them with our static electricity meter, and I didn't see any change very much during the nighttime. So it does seem to be affected by whether it's in the daytime or the nighttime.
Well, then, couldn't we fairly say then that that isn't a matter of light but heat? And why would we say that's just a change in the heat?
That could be what's going on. You know, that's a good – it's possible.
Okay.
You know, the sun is coming in there. There's heat. There's light. There's all sorts of things going on, and we haven't totally narrowed it down yet exactly what's
going on. All right. I want to return to that idea of measuring the non-human kind made crop circles. I want to ask Dr. Simeon Hyde about that coming up in just a second. You can link up to his website at coasttocoastam.com. At the top of the next hour, we'll open up all the lines and get you involved in this conversation too. But I want to go back to the connection between resonant viewing and these crop circles and the energy that's created by them next on Coast to Coast AM. My name's Ian Punnett. We're opening our minds with Dr. Simeon Hine, author of a book called A Journey of Extraordinary Encounters, Crop Circles and Resonance. And we're talking about resonant viewing, which is what he does now full time, after having been a sociology teacher, getting his PhD in sociology. And he's continuing with his scientific study of crop circles and other subtle energy phenomena. And we're just talking about these energies that are created by the crop circles, the ones that we can measure, some of which just the ones we can feel. And so some of it's inward, some of it's external, some of it is quantifiable. And what is in there for us, if it's true that, say, 80%, maybe 90% of these crop circles are man-made, then what can we still learn from them? And we're still allowing the possibility that 10% might be made by something else. But if you're talking about Earth energy, Dr. Hine, it sort of seems a little bit like we have to go back to that discussion, which you just kind of touched on briefly, about how these crop circles might be formed by some energy of the Earth. If that would that not explain then the connection to it giving off more, you know, wattage or how you're able to pick up on the increase in the energy field around these crop circles?
Well, yes, subtle energy science suggests to us that the Earth has its own subtle energy fields, which, by the way, are about 10 times weaker than the Earth's magnetic field. They're very difficult to measure. That's why they're called ultra-weak forces. So these aren't forces that are easy to measure, but we've always suspected that the circle is interacting with what sort of energy is there in the Earth and changing it in some way. Almost kind of like the crop circle is like an acupuncture point on the Earth. But let me give you an example of that.
That's an interesting comparison.
Yeah.
I mean, I just had a shiatsu massage, and I know how powerful that one little point can be.
Right. And let's give me a quick example of a circle that was made in the year, I believe it was 2000, in a place called Milton Hill Farms in England, very close to where a lot of the crop circles appear. There was a circle that appeared there around a dolmen. This is kind of a little hill that people made, the Neolithic people made a long time, thousands of years ago. And a group made a Celtic cross around that circle. Four circles connected by an outer ring around this little tumuli. That's actually the tumulus, the little hill. And we actually, I didn't know this originally, but we later learned the identity of all five people that were involved in making that circle, and I was able to talk to them individually, and I decided these were the people that did this. They knew everything about it and confirmed each other's stories. Well, Colin Andrews and an engineer went out there to measure that circle, not knowing, you know, if it was human-made or otherwise, and they dragged a magnetometer across that area all day. And what they determined was that in the four circles that this Celtic cross was made of, that magnetic north no longer pointed in the direction of true north. It was off by about 3 degrees when they were in the circle. But when they were outside of the circle, the compass worked again correctly, and the magnetometer detected normal magnetic readings. The actual pattern of the crop circle changed the magnetic field there. And Colin, at the time, thought the only way you could do that was by burying magnets in the ground. That there were magnets, very big magnets, not Alinko magnets, but, you know, really big magnets buried under the ground that was changing the magnetic field there. And yet, as far as we know, the circle makers that made that didn't bury any magnets. You know, they didn't do anything like that. They just made a formation, and near there it changed the magnetometer. I mean, the magnetometer was reflecting exactly the pattern of the circle, and it changed the magnetic field. Unless we have some other explanation, unless that pattern was there ahead of time and the circle maker subconsciously chose it because it had that pattern, which is certainly a possibility, it's possible that the circle changed the energy of the area. And again, that's what we've seen time and again, that the circle, rather than an energy coming down from the sky and creating the crop circle and creating anomalous energies in the field and all the changes we see in the wheat and the soil, another big possibility is that once the circle is there, regardless of who made it, whether you made it or I made it or ET made it, once it's there, it creates these anomalous effects, including the elongated nodes and the blown nodes and so forth. We've seen those in circles we've made. We made a formation at a place called Cheryl in 2003, and we found some elongated nodes, which I took a picture of, by the way. It's on the
right.
There it is, and that's long been considered a sign of authenticity, quote-unquote. But there it is in the circle that we made. So some of those litmus tests that I think some of the researchers thought might have shown a sign of the difference between a man-made and a so-called real formation, they're showing up in man-made formations too.
I think the Churl formation is obviously one of the most intricate that was done by humans. But I love the one that was done, the New Zealand formation. The one that was, isn't that the one that's used on the box set for the Led Zeppelin album? Do you know what I'm talking about?
Right, that the box set for the Zeppelin collection, that was the so-called key formation from Alton Barnes in 1991, I believe.
Okay.
That long 300-foot formation, which actually a replica appeared last year of that also. But that was the key formation. The New Zealand formation was another formation that was done by Matt Williams for a Japanese TV crew. I think it was Nippon TV. And he basically gave them 30 patterns and said, you pick one of those, we'll do it for you in a couple hours to prove to you that humans can do this.
When True North was off around that Celtic cross, 3 degrees to the west or to the east?
I don't know exactly. I believe it was off to the east, though I could be wrong about that.
That would have religious significance for Christians. And And then, what can you imagine if there really was a crop formation that was made by somebody or something other than humankind? And what if it had been made by ETs, as you described them, and it was in the shape of a cross? Can you imagine what would happen?
Oh, yeah. And I suspect, this is just a hypothesis, that this whole crop circle phenomena is a learning program for humans created by extraterrestrials or something, some intelligence that we don't know about, as a way of teaching us about Earth energies and patterns and sacred geometry. It's like a school.
Is that why you think these patterns just occur to people in the places where they believe they're supposed to put them?
Yeah, because they get the idea to do these patterns, and they've told me from time to time they don't even know why they get those ideas in their mind. I mean, they don't know where the creativity comes from. It's from a very deep place. But they feel compelled to go out and make these patterns. And in some cases, they've gone out in the field at night, and they said, you know what? It doesn't feel right. We're not supposed to be doing this. And they go home, and another pattern shows up there a couple days later, and they say, look, that's the reason. That pattern was a lot better than what we were going to do.
That's so interesting.
Yeah.
It kind of reminds me of sculptors who say that their job is not to create a sculpture, but merely to take away what wasn't supposed to be there.
Yeah, right. Because the circle is actually, in a sense, an empty space compared to the standing stock.
Right.
Kind of like that. Yeah.
All right, so we'll break here, and I will get our last part of our conversation between us. We'll tell people again that we'll open up the lines coming up for next hour at the beginning of the top of the hour. But I want to go back to this idea. I really want to try to bring it home for me, the connection between resonant viewing and crop circles, and what can and has been done with remote viewing when it comes to these crop circles. What have you been able to see? What have you been able to focus on? How do you tie those two things together? We'll do it coming up next with Dr. Simeon Hine on Coast to Coast AM. Dr. Simeon Hine talking about the crop circles and the resonant viewing, which he teaches at his institute in Colorado, the Institute for Resonance. And in your work, you tie these things together all the time, the idea of crop circles and resonance and this journey that we're on. What can you see when you resonate with these crop circles? How come there are so many questions about them if you can use resonant viewing to understand them?
Well, you know, resonant viewing gives us a lot of information about a lot of things, but it's not always so easy to interpret the results. If you're viewing an event in the future, or you can imagine people 100 years ago viewing something now, they might not know how to interpret the results. They didn't have computers 100 years ago, so if you were viewing a computer back then, you really wouldn't know what it was. Crop circles, in a lot of ways, are paradigm busters. They simply don't fit into any existing paradigm we have. If you think, you know, that they're all made by ET, I've got some friends I'd like you to meet.
Right.
And if you think they're all man-made, there are witnesses who've seen them happen very quickly around strange lights and things like that. So none of the boxes we try to fit crop circles in fit. It won't fit into the existing mechanistic paradigm. It doesn't fit into a three-dimensional paradigm. It's something from the future, and we're grasping at different ways of understanding it. But in the process, we're growing. We're expanding our sense of what we're capable of, our own abilities as humans, and intelligence that exists in the Earth and the universe that we might not have even imagined exist before.
I get that.
Right? So it's really causing us to expand, and that may be the whole purpose.
Okay.
And in the same sense, resonant viewing taps into these deeper intuitive creative abilities, which everybody has, but because of our conditioned, domesticated state that we've all been brought up in, and I think I've spent as much time in school as anyone, and I can say this honestly, there's a lot of things that we don't learn about that we should be learning about ourselves, about how our awareness works. We have a lot of power that we don't use.
Well, I love the thought of that, but allow me to go back to it one more time. We're talking about creating crop circles where you have been able to measure an increase in the energy within that circle, right? Or it changes even something like true north on a compass.
Right, exactly.
All right, so we know that something is happening there within that crop circle, even if it was human-created or extraterrestrial-created, something is happening in there, right? So we're tapping into a kind of energy that exists that's even bending the magnetic field, perhaps, okay? And yet, at the same time, then, in resonant viewing, you're also tapping into these existing energy paradigms, where, as you said, it is almost as though everything is happening all at once, just at different levels. And you can tap into that with remote viewing.
Right, right.
One would think that just, boom, you put those two things together, and you go and you do some resonant viewing within those crop circles, and you would be thinking that you'd just be kind of like exponentially increasing the power of one's resonant viewing, and they would just have that much more clarity about what's happening.
Well, you know, when we have viewed the circles with viewing, we've generally got a lot of extraterrestrial connection, which initially led me to believe that the extraterrestrials were literally creating these circles. I mean, all of them. But now what I believe is that it's humans' ability to contact perhaps extraterrestrial or some other intelligence through making the circles. In other words, the circles are a way to communicate back to the extraterrestrials rather than the extraterrestrials using them, making them to communicate with humans. So it really becomes like a two-way street. And the extraterrestrial connection is pretty strong in our viewing of the circles. But we also get a lot of other energies and my own sessions, things that I don't know exactly how to interpret them in, except to say they're anomalous energies and information. It's definitely something I think you could say, for lack of a better word, an interdimensional process. But let me just say that, you know, when you make a circle, you don't always get the effects every time. It doesn't happen every time. And that's what's interesting about it. One time a circle will appear and it'll affect a magnetometer. The next nine circles you measure won't. Some of them don't have any effect on the static electricity meter, and some of them do. Some of them affect our cameras, and then you could go for a year and not see that effect again. So what's really intriguing about it, it's not repeatable in the way that conventional science likes to see repeatability. That's why it's at the edge of science, because we don't, you know, it's like we're dealing with a machine and we're twisting the knobs around the dials. We don't know exactly what's going to happen when we twist the knobs and the dials around. So it's like a machine from the future, an etheric machine. And we don't know exactly what it is. Is it the shape? Is it the location? The greenness of the crop, the weather, the sunlight, all those factors and the intent of the people who go into it, even the people who visit it later. All of those, plus I'm sure many more things I haven't thought of, could affect the activity of the circle, the ability for it, to do something that we can actually see the result. We don't know, at least I don't know, and I don't think anyone really does, exactly what all those variables are.
Right.
And perhaps when we do, then it'll really be something where we can do it predictably. We can create it every time. And when we can create a circle that drains batteries, maybe we'll know how to create a circle that charges batteries.
Sure.
And we can feed it into the grid. And I'm not saying this to denigrate them, and like not to appreciate the wonderful artistic quality of them. It's just there's something else going on there that if we can tap into it, it's a lot like things you read nowadays with the field, the zero-point field, all of that.
Right.
We can tap into it, but I'm sure it's going to come more through intuition than calculation, at least at the moment it looks that way. Because okay. The circle makers, when they make them, just use their intuition, but boy, sometimes they get it just right.
Ever had a remote viewing session within a crop circle where you got people together and actually did that within a crop circle?
When we go to England every year, we actually do some viewing training to make people aware of the types of energies they may encounter in the circle. And people have occasionally done some of those sessions in the circle. And sometimes you may just do it, you know, informally, sit down and kind of let your mind wander.
Right.
And when you do that, sometimes you feel very strange things going on there, things that are hard to describe, contact with some other intelligence. You know, you almost feel like you're being watched when you're in the circle. It's kind of an eerie feeling. I know a lot of other people have had that experience. It's possible that that circle that we're creating, something is actually able to perceive us through the circle as if it's a lens.
Right.
That normally couldn't perceive us, and we can sense that a little bit, almost like when you're being stared at. You get that feeling in the circle. So,
I would just think that'd be an interesting experiment to do sometime, is get together 100 of the best, you know, resonant viewers with whom you're associated, and go and create a large crop circle somewhere in Kansas or Washington State or something. You go and create one, and then you have your next session right there.
It's a great idea.
Where it would seem to be there's some sort of weakening in the layers of the matrix.
Yes, right, right.
Okay. Before we go to phones, what other types of subtle energies do you work with? What are some of the other phenomena?
Well, you know, I'm actually interested in alternative healing methodologies. I practice Qigong and Tai Chi regularly. I do meditation also, just personally. I think those are different ways, easy ways for people to kind of get in contact with those different types of what I call planetary intelligence. You know, different types of natural intuitive abilities where there's an energy there that can be manipulated, like chi energy. So you were talking about the massage, you got the shiatsu.
Right.
That sort of thing
right.
manipulates a chi energy, and there's a lot of value in that. Even you can actually see it from scientifically controlled experiments that people actually improve from that. And there's also the effect of mind intent, of prayer, and that sort of affirmations, the ability of that to for people to heal faster. I think that's a very exciting possibility. People like Dr. Larry Dossey have worked in that field and talk about that. This subtle energy field has a lot of implications. It even goes as far as something that's very intriguing to a lot of people and is on the show sometimes, the communications with people that have departed the Earth plane and gone to another place. That's something I think there's some very good evidence for that, and that's certainly something in the future that this could be directed towards.
I think that would be a natural extension into what Art will do on Sunday night with the investigation of EVP.
And those EVP clips are very, very interesting things to listen to.
So all in all, energy at various levels of frequencies and, for that matter, occurrences. Some occur with a higher frequency in some area, and then they are infrequent with a low frequency in another area. They're not predictable. We can't map them out. We can't control them, it doesn't seem. I'm just summing this up. We can create crop circles where there is an effect and others where we might even repeat the same pattern that was used in another field, but it would not have the same impact that it had on the measuring tools for, you know, the appearance of energy or the increase of energy in an area. And so we can't control this. This is something you almost have to try to get out of your hands a little bit. Doesn't that challenge you as a scientist that all you can really do is sort of observe, almost more like an anthropologist might, and that you can't actually measure this or turn it into something which can be manipulated very easily?
That's right. To a large extent, that's true. You can't actually manipulate it yet. That doesn't mean someday we won't be able to. But, Ian, it's also a little bit like trying really hard to go to sleep. And some processes work better if you have to kind of relax into them, like resonant viewing. It works with a part of the intuition that doesn't want to be bossed around, and you actually have to work to get out of your way to make it work. In other words, it's like riding a bicycle. You can't think about it too much. It just, you're going to practice and it's going to work. And you're not aware of all the muscles that are making that happen. And a lot of these subtle energy processes are like that. You know, the work they did at Princeton with the random event generator, where they had people sit down and try to make this random generator go towards one or zero. And they did like hundreds of thousands of trials of this. What they found was it worked better when people actually weren't trying so hard. If they had their intent on affecting this random number generator, but they weren't really trying hard to make it change, just kind of had that intent in their mind. We find that this subtle energy field connects a lot better to our subconscious than our conscious kind of linear mind. It's a nonlinear process, and it demands learning skills that we all have, but we have to polish and work up a little bit to get them up to speed.
Well, maybe that's a problem by doing that sort of thing at Princeton. If they'd done that at my college, they would have found a lot of kids who really weren't trying that hard. It would have been happy to show up and not try very hard. You probably had a few of those when you were still teaching, I would imagine.
Sure, especially in my statistics class. But what I'm trying to say is it's a paradox. There's a lot of paradox here. So.
Out of time. Yep. Coming back with our last hour, we'll take your calls next for Dr. Simeon Hine on Coast to Coast AM. With crop circles, a scientific study of them, acknowledging about 80 to 90% of them are man-made, but it's that other 10%, which is fascinating. What could that be? And what is created even when humans are responsible for the crop circle? And Dr. Hine's been covering that for a while, and we've been enjoying that conversation. Lots of people want to jump in. You want to go right to the phones here, Dr. Hine? Let's get Kurt east of the Rockies on Coast to Coast AM. Kurt?
Hey, this is Kurt. I'm calling from Two Rivers, Minnesota.
Glad to have you. You're talking with Dr. Hine.
Hi, Dr. Hine.
Hey, Kurt.
I have a question for you regarding some circles that were talked about shortly before the initial attacks of 9/11, quite a bit on Coast to Coast, as a matter of fact. It turns out that they were a series of formations over in England, and I think, if I'm remembering right, they showed up in negative image, and then they later showed up in positive image, but they were also revealing a series of binary codes.
You're right. That's right, yeah.
Explain that and thank you, Kurt. What is Kurt saying there, that there was one image that was in negative and then it showed up again in positive? Was that people that you knew that were taking credit for those?
Yeah, what Kurt is referring to are some patterns that appeared in Hampshire County. I believe there was something that was called the Arecibo response message, and then something that was called the face. And the technique that was used there was something like more like a type of imaging system that would be used to print newspaper images and kind of lots of series of dots and dark spaces and light spaces. And it created really effective looking, really interesting looking images. And some people thought that they actually saw a code in that so-called Arecibo response message. The answer to the question is no, I don't know who did that. And there are always rumors around, but no, I don't have any direct knowledge of who or what made those formations. I don't think it's beyond people to do something like that. The farmer in one case did find a grid-like pattern the night before one of those showed up in his field, and then the next night it showed up. So it's possible that people were doing those, but I don't have any direct knowledge of those particular formations. But they certainly were a new way to make crop formations. They're not really crop circles because they're not in a circle, but it was a new type of system, and it certainly produces very good-looking results.
When you say a grid had shown up in the field the night before, meaning
right.
evidence of somebody laying out the pattern?
Right. I mean, Colin Andrews spoke to the farmer down there.
Okay.
I believe it was by a radio telescope. And the farmer told him that one day he came out there and the whole field had been turned into a grid.
Hmm.
And then the next night the patterns appeared. I think that would suggest that, humans were involved in that.
Right.
But, actually without being there and actually having more direct knowledge, I don't know anything more about those formations except that they really were rather startling looking. And they were a new, really new way to do it.
Let's go west of the Rockies where Awen is waiting for Dr. Simeon Hine.
Oh, good evening.
Hi.
Hello.
This is Awen from Roanoke Park. I have a question. Well, I have a comment first about the static electricity, and then I have a question. I'm really not surprised that you could measure static electricity at even a phenomenal amount in a small circle with all that, rubbing. First of all, air is kind of an insulator, so I would presume it would kind of keep it in that specific area as much as the people that were working there, and I could see all this energy being spent stomping and sliding around, so you'd be probably creating a lot of friction and energy. I don't know if it's a phenomenal amount for the work that you did, so I'm really not surprised about that. But I do have a question, in regards to the bent nodes and the other research that has been done.
Right.
And he had, traces of microwave residue or something like that, that kind of energy in some of his crop circles. And I was wondering if that was still true or...
Who are you referring to?
Levin, Good, and Talbot.
Right, right. Yeah, that's right. My interpretation of the results is that it isn't being created by microwaves, or if it is, it's something to do with the shape of the circle creating an energy pattern, kind of like if you're familiar with the idea of cymatic energy. The idea that shapes create infrasound. I think that might be a possibility that the shape itself is creating some very low frequency energy, but I do not believe that the circles are being created by microwaves, at least not most of them. I believe that's a misinterpretation of the evidence, because again, we found some of that activity in our own circles. I've seen some of those blackened and exploded nodes in other fields outside of crop circles, and even the results you're referring to, those researchers have found those types of nodes outside of the circles too. So what I'm wondering is, where don't you find them? If you find them in the circle and outside the circle, I mean, it's certainly possible an energy field came down and affected the circle and the whole field. But it's also possible that that type of activity, and I'm not trying to explain this phenomenon away, but I'm just suggesting the possibility that blown nodes and elongated nodes are just natural parts of fields. And you do find them in fields with circles and without circles.
Let's go to Bob, and then we'll go to a break, and we'll line up all of your calls on Coast to Coast AM, where Bob is waiting to talk with Dr. Simeon Hine. Bob?
Hi, this is Bob from New York. I wanted to know if Dr. Hine is familiar with a book called Unmasking the Enemy by Dr. Nelson Pacheco and Tommy Bland. Tommy Bland was a research associate for the UFO researcher, Dr. Hynek, and Dr. Pacheco was chairman of the math department at the U.S. Air Force Academy. Their contention is that crop circles and UFOs are demonic manifestations from another dimension. and I wanted to know what his feeling was on that.
Were you referring to Dr. J. Allen Hynek when you were talking?
Yes. The late Dr. J. Allen Hynek, one of his, it says here on page 425, that Tommy Bland was a research associate for Dr. Hynek, astronomer at Northwestern University.
Right. Yeah.
Right.
And they mention the Andreessen affair, where this woman, she saw four beings walk through her kitchen door, and they asked her for knowledge tested by fire, and she gave them the family Bible, and then they produced other Bibles that were bigger than the one she had, sort of like casting doubt on the Bible. And later on, when they put her under hypnosis, she spoke in a unknown language. He also talks about a crop circle in England that formed an ancient Hebrew word that meant woman or Eve.
Isha.
And, I think it was Hesha.
Isha.
Page 256.
Yeah, it's Ha-Isha, the woman. Yeah, that's very interesting. Well, let's get the response.
Well,
to...
you know, to answer your question, I mean, no, I don't think there's anything demonic about crop circles. I mean, honestly, I think they're some of the most beautiful, amazing patterns I've ever seen, and I know millions of other people feel that way. And if anyone has that reaction to the phenomena overall, I think it's more kind of their own judgment of the phenomena rather than anything that's built into it. Now, having said that, there are some circles that you don't feel good when you've been in them.
That's very interesting.
Some of them make you feel really good, and some of them don't. And even people that have taken the water from the circles that didn't make them feel good, when they started drinking the water again, they got the same feeling, almost as if the crop formation had an imprint on the water. And I know that the researcher Lucy Pringle has done a lot of research on the impact of the crop formations, the homeopathic effect of the formations on water. But some of them really make you feel great, and a few occasionally just don't. And I don't know why exactly, but I think I don't see anything at all negative about the phenomenon. I mean, I think it's really empowered a lot of people, and I've just had a good experience around them, and I know a lot of other people have, but the UFO phenomenon is certainly a very important topic. I know the late Philip Colonel Corso made some reference to crop circles. I think he said that the NSA determined that back in the 60s, at least they thought they were being created by extraterrestrials. At least that's what he said in the day after Roswell. So
it's a perfect time then to stop and come back and find all the wild card lines full, and if there's not, we'll get an open line for you next to talk with Dr. Simeon Hine about his research into crop circles and the connection that he draws between them and resonance viewing. You'll find out more about all of these on his website, which you can link up to at coasttocoastam.com. This is Ian Ponet. We will make time to get everybody in for Dr. Simeon Hine here and his research on crop circles. And Joe is on the wild card line to talk to him on Coast to Coast AM. Joe?
Hi, Ian. How are you?
Good. Jump in there.
Good. Dr. Hine, I had a question. You know, like in the United States, when we have, I believe, water when it drains in a bathtub or in a drain, we have, it goes clockwise. And in Australia, it goes counterclockwise as it goes down the drain. My question is, in the crop circles, the stalks of wheat, is there a particular way they are rotated or they are bent down? Is it clockwise or counterclockwise? And is there a difference between there and, say, the United States and maybe London?
Yeah, no, Joe, that's a great question. Actually, it seems that most of the circles in England that I've seen go clockwise. For some reason, the circle makers like to do it that way, and maybe the other type as well form in that direction. And that's a really good question, because we've often suspected that the flow of the radial lay of the wheat and the direction that it swirls in, you know, whether it's counterclockwise or clockwise, could affect the energy. It certainly affects it when you walk in the circle, because, you know, if you walk against the flow of the circle, that feels really different than if you're walking in the direction that the wheat is laid down. So that's certainly an important variable to pay attention to. But I'm not sure exactly the percentages, but it's certainly something to watch.
Larry on the wild card line for Dr. Simeon Hine on Coast to Coast AM. Larry?
Hi, can you hear me good?
Perfectly.
I'm on a cell phone.
Don't move.
Okay, I'm holding still right now.
There you go.
I'm out doing my job, and anyway, when the doctor was talking, and you were talking, actually, because you talked about a little bit of, you kind of related spiritual.
Right.
You have some training in theology?
Yes, I do.
All right. Well, I sit under, like, an old country preacher, but he's self-taught in Hebrew, and I had a friend of mine once say to me, don't let my mind wander, because it's too small, it might get lost.
Hmm.
I always thought that was kind of funny, but I was thinking about nature. And I think in Romans it says the natural types of spiritual. And I thought about it in the Old Testament. It says, meditate on my word day and night. And that word meditate, if you go back to the roots of the word, ties in with the word ruminate. That's what a cow does when it chews the cud.
Sure.
And even Paul compared the resurrection of the dead to the glory as of the sun and moon and stars. And the word glory, if you go back to the roots of the word in the Hebrew, ties in with your thoughts. And it kind of blends itself well with what you're talking about, because we don't necessarily understand everything and where energy comes from, but even the energy that's in our hearts, those nodes in our hearts, that's a form of energy, but we don't know the origin of life itself. And even like with our blood, it's so close to like plants, the DNA. And actually this pastor that I sit under, he teaches, he was big heavy in computers, and he's saying it's the same multiplication process that takes place with the division of cells at birth is the same multiplication process that takes place with the binary language. And considering all of this, I mean, I don't know if you've necessarily heard all this capsulated, but there's four letters in the Hebrew alphabet. It's the Yud, Hey, Vav, Hey, and their weakest letters, but they form the mighty name of Jehovah. And they're actually in Jesus, too, Yeshua, blessed, one more letter. But I look at all these things, and it's just really interesting. And what you're saying, I know Paul used the statue of the unknown God to share kind of what I'm sharing in a sense, too, you know?
Okay, well, let's get some feedback on that, and thanks for taking time away from your job. And I would say everything great that happens in the Bible happens after a wandering. So there's all sorts of wanderings, and then something fabulous happens. So I would throw that out there, too. But where are you with all what it
well,
was
yeah,
saying?
You know, Ian, we have to go into the unknown to find out more of our own abilities and who we really are. And I feel that, you know, what Larry's saying is true to the extent that we've really become disconnected from nature. And all the things we've been talking about tonight, you know, they're all natural. They're all there already. You don't even need machines to do it. We've become so connected to, you know, mechanical machines that we've lost a lot of our natural intuitive power, our natural intuitive abilities. And so, yeah, I think that this is what it's all about, connecting to nature, to our own inner nature, whether it's through wheat or it's through resonance. It's just tapping into those powers again. It's time for us to remember what we can do, what we're capable of doing, and to use those powers in a productive, positive way to improve our planet, to improve our lot on the earth, because we can do a lot better than we're doing right now. And the reason we're not doing better is because we're not really who we are. We're suppressing who we are. We're suppressing our natural innate abilities.
Let's go, Jim, wildcard line. For Dr. Simeon Hine on Coast to Coast AM. Jim?
Yeah.
You have a question?
Pleasure to speak. Yeah, I do. Great to speak with both of you guys.
Thank you.
Reverting back to the subject of remote viewing, if we, and by we I mean the government and these various organizations such as your own who practice or teach this on a daily basis, if we have this down to such an art, why haven't we found Osama bin Laden yet?
Well, that question, you know, comes up all the time, and I can only suspect that, A, either they're not using these viewers right now. Most of these viewers have said there is no longer any military viewing project. Nonetheless, a lot of people suspect that there may be a secret viewing project, but maybe it's convenient for some people not to find Osama, maybe for a variety of reasons.
Maybe they don't actually want to find him.
They don't want to find him. They want, you know, some political systems need enemies, you know. You know what I'm suggesting? And so maybe they don't want to find him. We don't know, but that's a possibility.
Easier to galvanize around an enemy.
That's right. Absolutely. It helps to have enemies if you're trying to generate support for your political regime.
Okay. Then can I offer to you that then I'm disappointed in remote viewers? Because it would seem like then they only remote view something like that if they're given some sort of governmental permission. Why couldn't they? Why aren't you all resonating in there, finding out where he is, and at least bypassing, you know, going to the press and saying, here's where he is. We can tell you the name of the cave. We can tell you the region that he's in. And then, therefore, putting pressure on those that would otherwise withhold that information.
Well, you know, Ian, I've worked with situations like that back at the Farsa Institute and on my own occasionally, and I found often that the authorities are not very receptive to that type of information. They're just very suspicious of it, how you came up with the information. If you're working in certain situations, you may actually even be considered a suspect if you know too much information. And maybe if you knew where Osama was, you might even be accused of being part of some Al-Qaeda network. Otherwise, how would you know? Do you see the
But you could do that on this show. But you could do that on this show. You could come
well,
on
I guess
here,
you could.
You could remote view, and you could say this is where he is. And if you have email contact with, you know, troops on the ground in Afghanistan, let them know.
You know, if someone came to us and asked us to do that, we might consider it. But I think it's getting into a very complex area, and it's also possible that people move around where you located them yesterday. They might not be the next day. And
it's actually a very complex issue.
But
I would think it would be a challenge maybe, but I think that if there'd be enough remote viewers out there doing that, that could affect a change maybe in how much or how we looked at information like that. Well, I won't press any more on it, but thanks for going with me as much as you did. Let's go wildcard line where James is standing by for Dr. Simeon Hine.
Yeah, this is James in Lake Geneva, Wisconsin.
Glad to have you.
I was listening to Dr. Hine's explanation as to why an electrical charge would build up in a man-made crop circle. And I think I like my explanation for that electrical charge better. has to do with a couple electrical principles that are well established, one being that you have electrical charges that build up and flow back and forth between the Earth and the atmosphere. Now, that was established by Benjamin Franklin. Another one being that an electrical charge will more readily discharge from a point than from a flat surface. Now, you got a wheat field full of corn, wheat stalks pointing straight up in the air. They're going to make for excellent discharge points. Whereas you go into a field and mash them all down flat, they're going to act as an insulator. So you're going to get an electrical charge that builds up both in the atmosphere above and the ground below.
Yeah, no, I like that. That's good. That's good thinking. That's exactly that makes a lot of sense.
But that would seem to take it out of the realm of anything supernatural, wouldn't it?
Well, no, the fact that we're getting a static charge doesn't mean that's all that's going on there. I don't want to suggest that. It's just one of the parameters you can look at. I mean, I really suspect that there's a lot of things going on simultaneously, and that's just simply one of the things that you can kind of measure pretty easily. But the fact that you can measure it easily doesn't mean that's the most important thing going on there.
Well, and we can just sit here and wonder what could possibly alter true north when being measured within a crop circle. All right, well, the phones are buzzing, and we'll get it all in if you can hang on for Dr. Simeon Rice in our last hour here, where your questions are going to drive this conversation on Coast to Coast AM. My name's Ian Punnett. And Dr. Simeon Hine, whose work is available for you at coasttocoastam.com. Just click onto the link and it'll take you to his website, and you can sign up there for his information and find out the latest, too, about some of his classes, which he teaches both here and in Japan on resonance viewing and on crop circles. Jeff is east of the Rockies with a question or a comment for Dr. Simeon Hine on Coast to Coast AM. Jeff?
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
Hi, Jeff.
Hi. My uncle was a shaman, a medicine man, and he was teaching me that you can make an energy field, actually, by making a spiral on the ground. You can either, you know, you could use wire or string, or, you know, you could draw it if you want. And it makes a lot of sense. An electrical engine, actually, it's like a spiral of wire. Or if you take a few nails and wrap a bunch of wire around it and connect it to a battery, that will actually make a magnet. So actually, with the spiral on the floor, like in a giant spiral, like, you know, 10 feet across, whatever, any size.
Right.
You'd actually stand on it, and you'll notice a difference, kind of like in the electrical wavelength, when you actually walk over it. You'll notice this. You could actually do this at home.
Notice a difference meaning what? It'll give you
Kind of like an electrical charge. You can feel it through your body.
Right. Dr. Hine,
Yeah, well, you know, Ian, this Coast audience is so asks such great questions. I mean, honestly, I've done a lot of radio interviews, and these questions are really based on some sort of really good knowledge. So I really appreciate these. And, you know, spirals are very important. That's what we're learning from crop formations. They're always or often built around these spiral patterns. And a lot of us suspect, you know, like you're saying, that it's literally the spiral pattern which may be funneling or channeling some sort of energy like you're suggesting in just a different way than we're used to seeing.
What about that as opposed to pyramids?
Well, again, we're dealing with a different type of geometry there. We often, in a crop formation, see the phi ratio as opposed in a pyramid where there's lots more of the pi, the ratio pi.
Right.
But these different sacred shapes are built on different geometries, and it's possible that people, you know, even thousands of years ago, knew more about that than we know now. You know, we may have forgotten a lot.
Right. So, well, ergo Stonehenge or something.
Right, exactly.
Right.
I mean, we don't know how to build Stonehenge quite like that. I've heard that those stones are heavier than most modern construction equipment can even deal with. So, and certainly a lot of the precision to which the pyramids were built. I mean, it may be that we've devolved from several thousand years ago in some senses, and that they knew about mathematical proportions and ratios and sacred shapes, ways to tap into the energies of the earth and the universe in ways that we don't know about anymore. And we're relearning them again through these subtle energy sciences.
I could see that. I mean, yeah. you look at all of these boy bands having to lip sync. It's not one thing that there's all these boy bands, but they also have to lip sync.
Yeah, what is that?
Talk about devolution. You talk about going
That's
back.
That's what I'm talking about, yeah.
Let's go to Mike, who's waiting for Dr. Simeon Hine. Mike?
Hey, good morning.
Morning.
Hi. Okay. My question's kind of off the wall, but then again, so is this program, as you will. You ever read any of the Roger Zelazny sci-fi fantasy series, series of Amber?
No, I haven't.
Okay. Well, yeah, within that, the main character is walking pattern, and through this certain pattern, they're able to acquire magical powers and do a dimensional travel. And it occurred to me that you know, maybe if we find the right pattern in a crop circle, there's really is a doorway to the dimensions.
Yes, right.
And it's kind of a, you know, I don't believe in coincidences, but so maybe, you know, the subconscious mind of Roger Zelazny was onto something there.
You know, exactly. That's how it works. It just spontaneously happens that people kind of understand these things. And the crop circles really do seem like some sort of interdimensional gateway to something else. It's like things go come from the circles and things go out through the circles. It's like a doorway to some other dimension that we can't totally see, but we can get little hints that it's there.
But by drawing it ourselves, I think that's kind of the interesting thing, too, is that we have the power of being able to do that. It's not, it doesn't seem to make sense. It doesn't seem like this should be something that we'd be able to tap into, but that by getting a group of people together and creating a crop circle, you're suggesting that then that creates a door. And that's interesting, as opposed to there being some sort of pre-existing natural door somewhere that, you know, that we would just kind of trip over, that we can help create it.
Yeah, it's a fusion between the group energy of the people involved in making it and also in the environment in which they're working. And, again, I think that people are capable of lots of things that no one ever told us we were capable of. I mean, I'm looking right in front of me right now at a spoon that I saw someone bend and twist into knots near Nagasaki, Japan, a man that had these telekinetic powers.
Right.
I mean, he could, and I mentioned this with Art the last time I was on the show, I mean, he could make my watch move around and spin just by touching it, a mechanical watch, and not just spin randomly. He could move it forward 1 minute, 5 minutes, exactly an hour. He could bend things like they were just liquid and give them to you, things he took out of your pockets.
Mm.
And, he said that he wasn't born that way. It was just something he practiced every day. He used to make insects kind of just imagine he could change direction, which they were walking just with his mind. And he realized he could, and he expanded it to bending spoons and, you know, just making things kind of bend just by looking at them. And, you know, we were talking before about the nature of intent and whether this is something you try to do or don't do. I'm not sure if you've ever been to a spoon bending party, Ian, or seen something like that, but I've been at some of the remote viewing conferences that IRVA, the Remote Viewing Association, hosts once a year. And what we've always been told at these spoon bending parties is you put your intention on bending the spoon and then you let it go, and that's when it bends, is when you stop trying. So there's something paradoxical about these subtle energy processes. They seem to work the best when you release your effort. You have to put the intent there, and then something in your subconscious keeps working even though you're not consciously trying. So it's very paradoxical and a different sort of learning experience than we're used to that we've learned in grade school.
Very interesting. Yep. Well, let's go to Ryan on the first-time caller line and then come back for the rest of the callers for Dr. Simeon Hine. Ryan?
Hey, how's it going?
You're on Coast to Coast AM.
Great. I asked a question for the doctor. If he's ever been capable of lucid dreaming, and if so, has he ever experimented with remote viewing in a lucid dream state?
Well, I have had experiences from time to time that seemed like lucid dreams where I woke up inside a dream and was actually able to, you know, maybe realize I was dreaming, but I was still in the dream. It's really kind of a neat state. And, you know, the Toltecs from ancient Mexico talked about that a lot, about our ability to control our own dream as if life is a dream and you're kind of waking up in your own dream. But it hasn't been something that really has happened to me a lot. It's just something that I kind of experience now and then. But I think it's, again, it's certainly related to a lot of what we're talking about.
These subtle energy phenomena, all part of the work of Dr. Simeon Hine. We'll get your questions and your comments coming up next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Since this is an international conversation, it's only fitting we should go to the international line where Josh is waiting to talk with Dr. Simeon Hine on Coast to Coast AM about his work in resonance viewing and crop circles. Josh?
Good morning. Calling from Tel Aviv, Israel. Thank you, Ian and Dr. Chaim.
Manishma.
Oh, thank you very much. Shalom. I was just curious. I was taken back by one phone call a little bit earlier. A man had made a good comment in asking, why wouldn't the government potentially, or somebody that could do remote viewing, maybe take down Osama bin Laden? And your answer fell a little bit short, in my opinion, for one reason. We have enough enemies, be it Zarqawi or a few others, that just to take down one, even Zarqawi, would do well enough if it was directly applicable. And so to say that it's not being done, or to imply that because we need enemies, is, I think, a bit inaccurate. And, I mean, I have some familiarity with the entire remote viewing program going back to McConaughey and some of the other fellows involved, and there's never really been, as far as I know, any practical application. Can you tell me, Doctor, has there ever been a practical application that you know of that was a dead-bang hit usable?
That's a fairly pointed question. Thank you, Josh. Doctor?
Thank you.
Where do you go with that?
It's a good question. In the history of the military remote viewing program, there were a lot of cases where they had really direct hits, and, you know, it was a slam dunk. The best example of that I know about, I've never worked with the government or the military. I've just worked with some of the people in that program. But there was the case when they found the Soviet bomber that went down in Africa. It went down in a brushy area or woody area. They couldn't see it from the satellite. They had a viewer come in. The person gave them the coordinates. They focused the satellite right there, and there it was. And they got the plane before the Soviets got to it. And so there are plenty of cases where there's absolutely no doubt that it worked very well. And that's from the military program. We also know that the same agencies came back year after year to the viewing unit. So I don't think they would have done that if they weren't getting useful information. But on the civilian side of things, which I'm actually more familiar with, there are people that have actually used this with a technique called ARV, where you can do short-term predictions of things like commodities, futures. I know Russell Targ did that with his group, and made various sums of money over time just to prove to people that it did work. And I know other viewers that have gotten about an 80% success rate. They weren't doing it to make money. It was more to show that this really does work. And, of course, money talks, so if you can use it to make money, it shows that it works. But, Ian, I want to say that I think the biggest use of viewing is to get to know yourself better. There are a lot of applications that people have developed for, you know, locating missing persons and playing the stock market. I think the biggest use of it is to get to know yourself better and the hidden powers and abilities, you know, that you have. Now, as far as Osama bin Laden is concerned, I don't work for the government, and I haven't been contacted by the government. I'm not really qualified to answer why they haven't found them, but I don't think it shows that viewing doesn't work. I just think it shows we live in a very complicated world with different political agendas, as we've seen in the past couple of weeks with different disasters. Katrina, for example, these agencies don't always cooperate with each other, right? So
right.
Some of them may have the information. They may not be sharing it with the agency that needs to get it. We know in other cases where viewers have worked with police departments that the police department, the sheriff's department, was competing with the local police, was competing with the local FBI. That happened with the Hearst kidnapping back in the 70s, which that's where our group worked on. So it can get very complicated. It's not quite as straightforward, but I believe that viewing's worked. I've seen it work many times. I think it was really positive results for lots of people.
And I think Josh's point, just to flesh that out a little bit, is interesting, though, too, that it doesn't seem to make sense that the government wouldn't do that to find Osama bin Laden, because there's always Zarqawi and there's always somebody else after that. And if they were able to bag these people one after another, that's when the approval ratings would go up. That's when they would be able to say, hey, follow us. Look what we got. Look what we can do. And
well,
it would seem like a kind of natural magic.
There's no doubt about that, but viewing is not 100% accurate, and it works best when you have other resources to use with it. You know what I'm saying. It needs other sort of information to go along to confirm whether the information is correct. So it's helpful, but by itself it doesn't always necessarily produce 100% accurate results.
That and a couple of satellites, you think, would do the trick. But
that would help also, yeah.
Let's go to Vincent, who's on the wildcard line for our guest, Dr. Simeon Hine on Coast to Coast AM. Vincent?
Hello.
Hello.
Yeah, I wanted to – well, first I want to start off by saying I'm a firm believer in the testimony of Yeshua and the will of Yahweh. And I wanted to ask if you had come across the crop circle. It wasn't a crop circle. It was 8th century Masonic order. Writing, and it was, we are opposed to cunning and deceit.
Okay. Ever heard
there
of that?
There was that circle that apparently someone decoded it. It had a binary code in it, and when they decoded it, it apparently had that message. But again, I don't want to, you know, burst anyone's bubbles here. I think it's perfectly capable for human circle makers to do something like that, just, well, maybe perhaps for fun. I mean, I'm going beyond the other circles that are there to create a kind of inspiring feeling. They may put a message like that in there just to see if they can do it.
Yep. And again, it would seem to beg the question of why not just put that in English? Why put it in a binary code?
Right.
But that's still very interesting. And Kevin on the wild card line for Dr. Simeon Hine on Coast to Coast AM. Kevin?
Nevin.
Nevin. I'll
yes,
take
sir.
Nevin. Go ahead, Nevin.
Nice talking to you. My question is, a few calls back, I heard you talk about dreams and being able to manipulate what's happening in the dreams.
Right.
And my son and I both are able to do this. My daughter's not. And my son and I both have, I guess you would call it premonitions or visions. Is that all related to this type of aspect of your crop circles and your other stuff you've been talking about earlier?
Well, yeah, the short answer is yes, because I believe that the same sort of spontaneous impulses that people get every day about intuitions about friends and relatives, and sometimes you get phone calls and you know who it is ahead of time, that sort of intuition, that is what remote viewing trains people to hone in on a little more. It's that same natural instinct we have to kind of care about our family and friends, and it's kind of a knowing when something's going on and knowing this. You can hone that in and work with that to make it stronger. So I believe that, yeah, these kind of intuitive subconscious sort of abilities we have are all at some level interconnected. It's just the level that you want to work with it at.
We probably have time for just one last call for John, east of the Rockies on Coast to Coast AM. John?
Hello.
Hi.
Hello there. Yeah, I was just curious if you were familiar with a phenomenon in quantum physics known as the Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen effect.
Right, that's right, yeah.
It really demonstrates that in the actual physical world, things are really kind of connected in ways that are unexplainable. And it would make a very interesting reading. There's a book by Gary Zukav called The Dancing Woolly Master.
That's right, yeah.
And he goes into a really excellent detail and does an excellent job of describing it in layman's terms is just absolutely fascinating. It really kind of lends a lot of credence to a lot of the things that other people might, you know, might otherwise find questionable, perhaps.
Well, I like that.
It's
like
a great comment. It's a great comment because a lot of people believe this has to do with what quantum mechanics calls non-locality related to, you know, so-called Bell's theorem, that you
right.
can have these non-local connections. In fact, Ian, this is what you brought up at the very beginning of our interview, that things can be affected across distances and they don't decay with the distance because the particles are correlated through non-locality, and that's why you can have these non-local effects and interactions. So it definitely has a lot to do with quantum mechanics.
I also started at the beginning of the show talking a story that people can link up to at coasttocoastam.com about a woman who is a clairvoyant in Italy who found the body of a missing woman.
Yes, that's right.
By hearing her, seeing her at the bottom of this lake, Lake Como. And the police weren't looking there, and the family wasn't looking there, and there had been a thought that she'd either run away to Spain or she had committed suicide. And yet she saw that there
mm-hmm.
with her clairvoyance. Talk in the minute we have left about the difference between clairvoyance and remote viewing.
Well, the only difference, it's minimal. The only difference is that remote viewing, most people, the way we think of it, it's a little more driven by a protocol and a method. Clairvoyance could be a little more spontaneous, like this woman, the experience she had. There was also cases like that in Seattle. You might remember it last year where a teenager drove over a cliff coming home from a party. And the search, 200 people were looking in the wrong place, and a neighbor had a dream where the teenager came to her in the dream and said, I'm over here. And the neighbor just went there by herself, and there was the car. And 8 days later, the girl was still alive, and they found her. So this does happen spontaneously. And, again, it's the same sort of skill that really shows that it's real and useful, too.
Well, I certainly resonate with that story. And
yep.
I wish we could do that all the time with those people who are missing now in New Orleans or in the Gulf Coast area.
Absolutely.
And whatever work that Resonance viewers can do to help reunite families together, I hope that Resonant viewers and remote viewers will consider doing that.
It's a great idea. Yeah.
And thank you for your candor and your openness and taking all of these questions to, you know, even sometimes taking us in areas where neither of us could have predicted where we would have gone.
Thanks very much, Ian. Can I just give out the 800 number for the Opening Minds book if people don't have a connection to a computer?
Go ahead.
It's 800-247-6553.
Do that again.
800-247-6553 if you don't have a computer and want to get a copy of Opening Minds. And, Ian, thanks very much for the interview and the whole Coast audience. It was a great, a lot of great topics we covered.
Well, thank you so much, and enjoyed it, too.